This is Mental, the podcast that destigmatizes mental health. I'm Bobby Timms.
I'm Annie Harris.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about burnout. So to start off with, I've got two definitions. The first is from the Cambridge English Dictionary. Why is that difficult to say?
I don't know.
Is it because I'm not smart enough to get into Cambridge, so therefore can't even say it right? So that place said, burnout is extreme tiredness or feeling of not being able to work anymore caused by working too hard. And for contrast, Urban Dictionary describe it as a state of emotional and physical exhaustion. I actually felt in this case the Urban Dictionary one was a bit more accurate myself. What do you reckon?
There's quite a lot of truth to both of them, really. For me, I really struggle with working too much for my condition. So that when you said about not feeling like you can work anymore, that really rung true with me, actually. That made a lot of sense.
And so I've got some key facts as well for that. One is, while not considered a mental illness, burnout can be considered a mental health issue. According to the Journal of Applied Biobehavioral Research, burnout is having a growing impact on workplaces, in particular in advanced economics and during times of economic downturn. So that's just a bit of general information really about where burnout fits in terms of not being a mental illness, but it can be considered a mental health issue. So it's not diagnosable, but it is a widely acknowledged factor and can be a cause of mental illness more generally.
Sure, I totally agree. I always love it as well when things get defined in a way that people who run businesses kind of understand. So when we're talking about economically and stuff, it gives me such like a justice boner to be like, yes, look how these things are affecting money and businesses. Maybe people will start to sit up and take these issues really, really seriously. So I'm really, really glad to get it in that sort of setting and that it's affecting things economically.
Right, absolutely, and particularly where it's mentioned there, it's more prevalent during times of economic downturn. I think that was really something felt in the credit crunch, you know, that I remember. Like, there was this a lot of pressure in businesses to work extra hard, but for the same money, and then they're kind of surprised when people are struggling more.
Yeah, that was totally, I'm sure we could find heaps of examples in history if we look back through, I wonder what happened during like the Wall Street crashes. Like,
well, that's it. During any periods of recession, really, there'll be that correlation.
For sure. Oh, I am so burned out at the moment, I'm not going to lie. Like, I'm recording this from my bed.
Are you the case study?
I am Horizontal Harris today. I'm living my dreams.
And so I've actually got one relating to workers like yourself. 526,000 workers in the UK suffered work-related stress, depression or anxiety in 2016/2017, so that financial year, and 12.5 million working days were lost as a result over that period, and that's from Health and Safety Executive. And, you know, I like to crunch some of these numbers. So I worked out if you divide down the 12.5 million working days lost to the 526,000 workers, it actually works out at 23 days lost each.
Wow. So my goodness.
That is a massive amount. And that is more than you'll see from, you know, the flu that's going around the office. It's more than you'll see from the tummy bugs, and even other reasons people take time off work, like 2 weeks statutory amount you get for bereavement in most cases. So it's really significant. And, you know, time and time again, we come back to this on the podcast. We come back to talking about education and we come back to talking about workplaces. Burnout is a really clear area where we can expand on that further. So one more thing that I could really relate to was that although anyone can suffer from burnout, according to Psychology Today, it is often associated with high achievers because of their I-can-do-anything personalities. So that's something that both, Well, I think you, I, and
I feel personally attacked by this. Yeah,
it's a really common one, and it's interesting how you can find these kind of correlations. For me, working as hard as I work, depression really affects that, and I'm very aware that burnout could be round the corner a lot of the time if I overstretch myself.
Yeah, sure. That's something that's on the back of my mind and the back of my partner's mind quite a lot, as we're always really on hyper alert, watching my fatigue levels and watching my pain levels and my mood levels as well. It's a really real issue that we live with, and I'm sure heaps and heaps of other people do as well.
Yeah, but it's so important that you've got that awareness, that you're both looking out for the signs and know what they are. That's such a vital step, really.
I very much came from a background of like, oh, you've got a bit of a headache or a bit of a tummy ache, it's probably nothing, shake it off. And Sam coming from a background of all of his sort of mum's side of his family are all in the medical field. He's really, really attentive and not so much like, oh, shake it off, it's probably nothing. He's more like, well, just sort of take that as a sign that it's time to slow down. Even if it feels like a headache that I might sort of shake off, I've actually been really grateful for Sam being like, no, I think it's best that you get some rest. And I'm like, and it's turned into a migraine later on. I'm like, oh, thank God I didn't push myself through that migraine or sort of go out when I wanted to, because otherwise I would be now out of the house with a blistering migraine. So I'm really lucky that I have somebody that's got my back in those situations. Like, it's been a real, real improvement, I think. Since we've been together, I've noticed that my symptoms have been significantly better managed because somebody has got my back. I'm very fortunate, and I'm in a very fortunate position to be able to say that. I just really wanted to highlight the importance of having a buddy, even if it's not like a romantic partner or a family member, but just at least a buddy who understands what you're going through, to keep an eye on your warning signs effectively.
Yeah, for sure. That's really lovely to hear. And so for the listeners at home, I've got some examples of signs, symptoms, and characteristics of burnout. These are also from Psychology Today. So I'm just going to pick out a few that particularly resonate with me. So physical and emotional exhaustion is a kind of general overarching one. Cynicism and detachment, ineffectiveness and lack of accomplishment. And that can be either a feeling of that or literally struggling to achieve anything. Chronic fatigue, forgetfulness or impaired concentration. That's something I definitely experience a lot. Insomnia, physical symptoms as well can come into it. So you can be more prone to catching coughs, colds, common illnesses that are going around.
I always get tummy aches when I'm burned out. I think it's due to the anxiety. I always get a tummy ache if I'm feeling really, really exhausted.
I think these are all examples of how all-encompassing burnout can be. You'll hear that really when we talk to our guest as well, how it really stopped her life in its tracks. But so many of these symptoms relate to mental illness, but it's also broader than that. It's every part of your life, really, whether it's your productivity, whether it's your alertness, your memory, how prone you are to either potentially this triggering mental illness or this contributing to existing mental illness. And then the last thing I wanted to finish up with was a specific study looking at social workers. So we've previously talked about members of the NHS quite a lot, but social workers also have a hugely challenging role. So I'll just read from that. In what is one of the largest studies of burnout among social workers in the UK, a total of 1,359 people completed the Mashdal Burnout Inventory. So that's a scientific measure of burnout. The study found that high levels of emotional exhaustion in the majority of respondents, so 73%, with 1 in 4, 26%, reporting high levels of depersonalization, which describes the process of becoming emotionally hardened towards service users. So I found that particularly powerful, not only in how prevalent these symptoms of burnout were in this industry, but also when 1 in 4 are reporting depersonalization, part of that is becoming hardened towards service users. That's when it gets particularly dangerous in situations like that, not only for the person doing the role themselves, but they need to remain empathetic in order to fulfill that role up to a certain point. A lot of being a social worker is having to make very tough decisions, and you need to be able to emotionally connect and weigh up all sides, including how everyone feels, to make that best decision.
It's really easy to see why that would be so dangerous, but it's also worth highlighting that if we've got people in these situations that require them to be at their best, then we should be funding them with appropriate money to do their job correctly instead of having their funding cut. It just makes me so furious.
Right, absolutely, because social workers make and are involved in decisions that change people's entire lives.
True.
And that really can't be underestimated, the pressure on them, but also the support they need to do their job well.
Yeah.
So that's one specific example I wanted to finish up with on the research. And so we'll be getting into the episode shortly with Suki Bassi. She was introduced to me via a close friend who I'm hoping to get on the podcast in the future. And Suki is a really inspirational lady that runs an organization all about supporting people in the workplace and in their life in general to have optimum mental health. So this episode is all about burnout, so both what she's learned being in a role like that, but also really a very personal telling of her burnout story. We'll get into that in just a moment, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm Suki Bassi. Exactly 10 years ago, I had a full-on breakdown, which was caused by unaddressed burnout. And I would say that my burnout issues probably started a good 2 to 3 years before. And it took having a full-on breakdown to actually realise that I could have mitigated some of the extreme symptoms if intervened earlier, down to actually look at the whole pattern of how I lived my life, how I worked, how I played, how I recharged, for me to realise there's something very disconnected going on. We have a lot of mantras around workplaces, which are very much work hard, play hard. And realising that for most of us, that's a very, very broken mantra to live by. And I think when I started recovering from my breakdown, the one thing I wanted to avoid in the future is a repeat of what had happened to me. And for me to now be far more aware and far more cognizant of what those symptoms would be. What's the difference between I'm just overworked to I'm approaching burnout, and what's the difference?
It sounds like at the time you were aware that a lot of these symptoms were there. Could you talk us through what some of those were and like how you were rationalising them away as other things?
Yeah, I've had episodes of depression in most of my adult life. So the one thing I really appreciated, now I certainly appreciate, is that some of the symptoms of depression and some of the symptoms of burnout can be pretty identical. But then some of the symptoms of burnout can also be identical to other things, right, such as jet lag or nutritional deficiencies. And so a lot of symptoms, if you think about it, don't happen to us in a vacuum. So I was in my 30s at that point. So I would put things like fatigue down to I'd just partied too hard, or I've just been, you know, working too hard, or I'm jet lagged. I didn't connect any of the dots, even though one of my GPs had flagged that I had some deficiencies in some of my blood tests, didn't think that that was a big deal. So I always used to think that how I would balance a stressful work life was to have a full-on social life and to have a full-on gym life. And I thought that that's how you were supposed to do it. So a lot of the symptoms that I was feeling, especially around fatigue, or this is quite an embarrassing one for me, a lack of empathy for other people, mm-hmm. or the fact that I'd be very short-tempered, I would put down to other factors.
Right, but actually that's quite common with burnout. It's really part of a larger symptom of struggling to keep up with the emotional demands of just living a day-to-day human life, that you've got too much going on with the exhaustion. It creates this kind of irritability.
Absolutely. And I think also with a lot of modern workplaces, We have an environment where the more you volunteer for things, the more that you say, oh, I will take that on, the more respected you are, the more kudos you are given. I have never in all of my working life had a line manager say to me, Suki, are you sure? Mm-hmm. Are you sure that you didn't take enough of a break off the last project before you throw yourself into this one? And especially in the beginning of my professional life, I worked in the non-profit sector. So I worked on very hardcore issues. So we're talking about the Rwandan genocide. We're talking about anti-trafficking. We're talking about domestic violence. So I very much had this guilt inside of me that if I wasn't putting in the hours, if I wasn't putting in the work, I was letting down people. So I already had this inner critic that your issues pale into insignificance compared to the projects that you're working on. And if you do have any failings, it's a personal failing and you just need to push through it.
It's funny the way we're so good at doing that as people, particularly the more you care about others, the more altruistic you are. It seems to correlate with you being really good at internalizing all the things you're doing badly, and then all the things you're doing well, oh, that's coincidence, or that's my organization, not me personally.
Absolutely. And I think that the only common denominator I could ever see when it was myself was when something was messed up. When I remember thinking, when I looked at even things like my fatigue, and I was obviously conscious because I'd had episodes of depression at the end of university. So I was conscious that, okay, are these symptoms of depression? And when I could see that they weren't, and I'd have fatigue and say maybe I'd sleep all day on a Sunday, the amount that I would hate myself, that I was lazy, that it was slothful, it was slovenly, what would any of my colleagues or my friends think if they could see me? And you're absolutely right, Bobby. And then if there was a success, if there was a win on a project, well, that was teamwork, that was collaboration, that was the fact that I was on the shoulders of giants. That inner voice was always perpetuating, I think, even the issues of burnout, because again, you'd feel like you needed to do more. You were never doing enough.
Yeah, absolutely.
I already had that disconnect from my early years. So with my father, he really pushed us to be very high achieving. And you'll find that with a lot of immigrant families, that whole thing of sacrifice, we moved to this country to give you a better start. And you are going to reap the rewards of that hard work. So I think I'd internalized a lot of that. The way I sometimes see it now is I didn't really have an internal barometer or a compass. But exactly like you said, that whether it is a practical or pragmatic approach to what your skills are, or it's imposter syndrome, or it's the inner critic, that was an unwelcome companion for most of my 20s and 30s. And it took a breakdown to shut it up a little bit.
Right. But that is a very common immigrant experience as well. You know, when you're second generation, it's a lot of pressure to have from a family that you need to somehow carry the torch of our struggle, but it can also mean you have a lot of inherited trauma, I find. So you have your parents' struggle emigrating, then becomes your struggle, even though here you don't actually have it. Am I explaining that okay?
Absolutely. I got divorced in my late 20s, mm-hmm. and I think that a lot of my 30s were about making up for that to not just my parents but to the wider community.
Right.
That if I can succeed within my career, it will earn me some sort of forgiveness for being divorced. And you mix that with this inner need to give back, to contribute, this thing that I was never enough. It was always had to be projects that were some of the darkest things that, you know, any human can be exposed to. And so I wonder whether there was some sort of penance also going on, that, you know, I'd broken this taboo by having a divorce, so that there was some sort of, you know, penance going on. But I think really within the professional environment, we talk about achievement as this fantastic, you know, slope that can only go one way, without ever questioning what hours people are putting in, what other sacrifices they are making, what toll it is possibly taking. Mm. So I think from my experience, because I don't want to make it just about myself, it is realizing that we create working cultures where we don't want to look at the golden cow too closely. Or is it the golden goose, not the golden cow? The golden goose too loosely, in case we have to sort of examine how we work. And I think that, especially from my experiences, I work very differently with colleagues and with, you know, teams, or, you know, with anybody working under me or working with me, for that simple reason that sometimes the golden goose isn't quite what it's cracked up to be.
Mm-hmm. Something you've reminded me of there that I think about a lot myself, again, to come back to the immigrant experiences, the kind of irony that your family is working to set up a better life for you, and to some degree an easier life. And so if anything, that should give you the freedom to have a divorce and it not ruin your social standing or not jeopardize your financial situation, not the other way around. But I think because potentially our parents have been held to a certain standard, we inherit that down that you parent like your parents did. And so that can sort of be inherited down, a level of pressure that actually jeopardizes the freedom that supposedly we should have being here.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And also, I think if your life experience, especially from your early years, is quite rigid and constrained and regimented, you don't actually learn where your own boundaries are. So that bit of what was actually me took decades to emerge. So that thing of, am I existing by somebody else's moral compass or is it my own? And I think that that disconnect had always been there, but it just became more and more fractured as other things were getting rocky for me, that fracture was coming more and more to the surface. I remember once in my 30s trying to explain to a therapist that I felt like I existed in the void that was created by other people. So as a sister or as a daughter or as a friend or as an employee, that I was the bit that was the void, that I only knew myself in relation to my other relationships, and that bit of to not actually know yourself.
Right.
And I think that that was probably a factor as well in my burnout and my breakdown, because you can only keep these facades and these masks up for a certain length of time before it all just comes crumbling down.
Right, that's a really powerful way of phrasing it, because it happens so frequently where we're put in positions like that by other people, that we're sort of caricatured as, you're the one that holds the family together. Yeah. And so then we easily assign our worth to that, that I'm only useful to the extent I'm useful to others. Mm-hmm. And then it's no surprise that you're then having situations like sleeping in on a Sunday and feeling guilty about that, because that's where your worth is. And that's something that I still have to work on myself with my own depression, not tying my self-worth to my work, so that I can actually have a day off because it makes me better and then I work better. But actually, that's only a half improvement. Really, I need to get to a place where I'm able to take the self-care just for the sake of the self-care and not have to bring it back to work, even in a more loose form.
Absolutely, Robin. That brings me to one of my favourite expressions, which is self-care is not selfish.
Right.
And that is a hard lesson to learn. You know, in some of the workshops that I deliver, and especially when I'm working with women, but it's not gendered by any means. And one of the expressions I use is, you put your own oxygen mask on first.
Right.
For you to be a great mom or a great business person, or for you to be a great podcast host, you've got to be okay first. And especially when we give so much of ourselves to the point where we just go, okay, what's left for me, what's left of me, that you know, that's where the fragility starts.
Yeah. And even if you're not at a place where you can fully accept that the self-care is necessary, irrespective of any other factors in your life, even before you reach that point, there's still ways that you can rationalise it for the benefit of others, because ultimately you can't be a good parent, a good friend,
Absolutely.
A good sister, any of these things if you're not looking after yourself.
Absolutely.
If you're at rock bottom, you're not going to be great to be around in any way.
You have to be okay first. You have to be okay first. And that takes, I think, a force of will. That really is. I would say that is a working practice that I have to remind myself of pretty much daily.
And I think it's really universal as well, because irrespective of whatever family you're born into, the first people you're surrounded by, you're the priority of. You're the most vulnerable and young person in that situation, and you need the most attention and looking after. It sounds like with the history you've had, that's been exacerbated. But I think for any person, it's a learning process, that actually, as much as your family's number one priority, or at least should be when you're really little, they've still got to look after themselves too.
Yeah.
Just because you're someone's number one priority doesn't mean you should be their only priority. And equally, that's something you have to learn to then create a good and healthy family yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think showing kindness to yourself for most people is a challenge.
Right. But on the simplest level, if you can't learn to be kind to yourself, how can you do it towards others? So often I see even close friends of mine in relationships where I catch certain things they do, and I recognise them from movies or TV or Disney. And I think, is that something that you actually do because you know the person likes it, or because you like to receive that kind of love, or is it just a stereotype? And so there's a certain amount of getting to know yourself and learning to look after yourself that is mandatory to be good at caring for and being kind to others. And so with this kind of backdrop, we'll backtrack a little bit, because this is obviously a lot of where you are now. In comparison, where were you at in your work leading up to your break? Where was your mind at?
I think so the issues of the burnout were beginning to manifest in different ways. So this would have been around sort of 2004-2005. And even as I was aware that something was really off kilter, you know, you tried to sort of course correct, and I think I over course corrected, and I sold my house in London at that time and moved to India to set up a yoga retreat, thinking, well, you know, a change is as good as a rest. And if anyone knows India, they will know that it is one of the most phenomenal countries on the planet, but also one of the most challenging countries on the planet.
And competitive.
Yeah, to move there, to be, you know, single, be a female by myself, the sexism, the fact that every single bureaucratic form that I had to fill in started with husband's name or father's name as opposed to my name, working practices, a lot of corruption. But yeah, so that's how I decided to deal with my you know, unaddressed burnout, which is, well, a yoga retreat will be nice and relaxing. And so I spent about a year and a half in India, and it had highs, it had lows, and everything in between. And I think my yoga was keeping me grounded to some extent, even though a lot of the other issues with regards to the stress that I was under, the financial pressure I had just put myself under, were actually increasing. Things came to a head at the beginning of 2006.
Can we just pause for a moment? Because
yeah.
I just think it's so interesting, given your attitude to work up to that point, that your idea to improve your work life was to take on a new work project.
Yeah.
Like, that is far too relatable for me.
Because that's how you do it, isn't it? You still have to be an alpha person, but you throw yourself into a different line of being an alpha person. And so a yoga retreat seemed like the sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
And I find it amazing that out of my wide network at the time, that no one just took me aside, gave me a good shake and went, actually, Sukes, what are you doing? What are you thinking? If anything, I was just like, I had people saying, if anybody can make it, it will be you. It will be brilliant. I'll come out and see you. People sending me copies of Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love that came out about 6 months after I'd embarked on this adventure, sending me copies and going, oh, I was thinking of you, except I didn't go out with a book deal. And so, and I think I'm one of those people that then lives that narrative, that it's that, of course, I'm going to make a success of it. I'm only going to have
right.
to work 6 months of the year. The other 6 months I can be sunning myself around Goa or Barbados. But of course it's going to work.
And I think this is a part of a bigger problem that leads to a lot of burnout, this sort of binary narrative that we're either strong people or weak people.
Yes.
And we really buy into that. You know, you kind of know where people put you on that, and therefore you can easily identify with it. But that's bad whether you identify as strong or weak.
Yeah.
It's to your detriment, because actually we're all on a sliding scale of needing support. We all have an upper limit for how much work we can handle before burnout, before other things really crash in to slow us down. You know, life has a funny way of giving you what you can handle and then pulling you back down when you overstretch.
Yeah, and I think all I did was change the landscape of where I was. Yes, it was far more beautiful in India than it was in South London, but that's all I'd done. So maybe I'd bought myself a little bit more time. That's all I'd done. You're absolutely right. And then at the beginning of January 2006, I had a family tragedy back in the UK. And so I found myself back in the UK without a permanent base, grieving for the loss of my brother and dealing with a lot of, you know, bureaucracy and family stuff that came out after that. And for that year, I think I ran on adrenaline. I think that, again, that bit of me that can come through for other people if I can't come through for myself kicked in. So that bit of I need to be there for my siblings, I need to be there for my parents, I need to be there for my sister-in-law who'd been widowed and had a seven-month-old baby. And so I think for that 12 months, I don't want to use the expression dug deep because I don't know where it came from, but you know, I carried on doing my yoga, but it was just I can come through for other people. And I think it was at the end of that 12 months when I'd done what I needed to do and then had to sort of go, well, okay, who are you again, that the burnout really reared its ugly head. This time there was nowhere for it to hide.
Yeah, and it sounds like you'd got to a limit on it because you'd become so good at covering it up. I doubt your yoga students realized you were stressed because you have to put on this facade of being the most zen person as an example to them.
I think that you've put on such a face for yourself and then you put it out into the world that it was the face that, you know, that my siblings could rely on, my parents could rely on, my friends could rely on, that, you know, if you wanted something done, you gave it to Suki, that I needed that narrative because it was my fuel. And I think I was actually living off that, that one by one, it's back to that whole void analogy, that one by one, that, you know, people seemed to be okay and they could stand up by themselves. I was just left with, well, who am I? And again, you know, I still kept thinking that I needed to power through stuff. If only I could work harder at things, I'd come through the other end. And the straw that broke the camel's back, and it's a very spooky story, is running the first ever Birmingham Half Marathon. So I did that on the Saturday or the Sunday, you know, thinking, well, of course, exercise makes everything better. I'll sign up for the inaugural Birmingham Half Marathon. And then the following week, I couldn't get out of bed. I can't say I didn't get out of bed. I could not get out of bed. My whole body had shut down. It had shut down. I was staying in my parents' spare room. The bathroom is probably no more than 10 or 11 steps away. It was all I could do to make it there and back in to bed. And that was pretty much the picture, not just for a week, but for nigh on 6 months. That my whole world went from being global. At that point, I'd, you know, lived in the US, I'd lived in India, I'd lived in London. It just shot in on itself. And it was the size of a tiny spare room back at, you know, a town that I'd left when I was 17 years old. And I think it was a really good reflection of how I felt in my mind, that everything just zeroed in. Yeah, and there was, I can't even say that it was bleakness. It was an absence of anything, an absence of everything. I wasn't in physical pain that I could tell you about. I wasn't even in mental anguish like I'd been in the past with my depression. It was somebody had pulled the plug out and I'd forgotten where it was.
Right. I'm reminded of a quote by J.K. Rowling. So she describes depression as an empty, hollowed out feeling. And that's how it really sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I experience too when I'm at my worst. And a big reason why so much of my life so far has been kind of governed by work, that historically it's been used as a coping mechanism, as a way to run away from the depression. And I'm a lot better than I was, but I'm still working on getting better than that, because there's still that fear inside me that if I stop working for too long, I might just sink into hopelessness and then I won't know what to do next. Mm-hmm. Whereas at least when I've got work and all these people relying on me, there's a clear next step all the time.
Mm-hmm. I can really recognise that. I really can, Bobby. And the way I try to look at it now is it's not so much work as our connections.
Right.
Because I think I always saw it as work, but I think for me now it is connections, that I struggle to be accountable to myself, but I don't struggle to be accountable to other people. And I don't just mean from work. If I promise you that we're having lunch tomorrow, I will be there. And so that bit of I've stopped beating myself up that I can't be enough for myself, and I go, do you know what? I have amazing people in my life. And if my life's work is to be there for them, do you know what? That's more than good enough for me. And that is, again, like self-care, an exercise I have to repeat to myself, because it is like a muscle. You have to keep working it every bloody day for it to remember. And that's what I hold on to.
Yeah. And so was that what helped bring you out of the breakdown?
There wasn't one particular thing. I think the breakdown was so all-consuming, and because it physically shut me down for so long, the only way I can see it, explain it, is that it literally rewrote some of my neural pathways, that any of the optimism or drive or confidence I'd had before had just disappeared. So there's times when I would literally, you know, look at my CV or think about what I'd done, and it was somebody else that did it. That my current existence bore no relationship at all to anything that had gone before. And the fact that I think I'd ended up in my childhood town, like I say, I'd left when I was 17, probably again exacerbated things. The fact that most of my friendship and social networks were in different cities or even in different countries exacerbated it. The fact that because I had such a global network, I could lie by omission to people. So people in New York were like, well, she's having a fab time in London. People in London, she's having a fab time in Mysore. People in And so that bit of you fall through the cracks, that because people haven't heard from you, they just think you're off on your next big adventure.
Yeah. And you've always come across as so strong. Why would they suspect that you're struggling?
Absolutely, absolutely. And then after not working for 6, 7, 8 months, I was then financially constrained, that even if I had wanted to reach out to friends, the thought of, well, I can't afford to go out for dinner. When the bill comes, I'm not going to be able to pick up my half of the check. So there, all of that was exacerbating what had gone from being burnout to a breakdown to then becoming full-blown on clinical depression. But it was all of those different layers adding on. And I would say the process to recovery was just slow, Bobby. It was the simplest things, such as connecting with nature. So even on days, this was like a good 6 months or a year into it, to go, okay, I'm going to take a walk in the park. I haven't cleaned my teeth. I haven't showered in days. But I'm not really going to be sitting across, having coffee with someone. I can just take a walk. The other thing that I developed was my art practice. At that point, I didn't think I had a creative bone in my body. But I started... It started with beading, and then I developed into sort of silversmithing skills. But that the process of creating something, of something having a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I don't know whether it was the dopamine kick that it would give me for the completion, or it was the sense of achievement that even if it was something really small, if I made a pair of earrings and sent them to my sister or to my best friend, it was a human connection.
Right. And I think there can be so much to simplifying right down to the, here is a simple process that I'm going to go through today several times. And it sort of lends itself to a mindfulness.
Absolutely.
That you have to slow down and reassess and actually check in with yourself.
Yeah.
Because one thing that sounds like a bit of a through line with your life up to this point was you were running away from situations, but potentially you were running away from your own problems, and therefore they followed you. Mm-hmm. And then you'd find a new project to do and just keep distracting yourself in that way. Whereas then everything changed when you were forced to stop and forced to slow down and shrink your attention right down to the here and now. It sounds like a real breakthrough
Absolutely.
Moment for you.
I think that's very insightful, Bobby, because what also comes with that mindfulness is a change of pace. So I'd gone from somebody that really thought you've always got to power through to just going, no, this is okay. If all I did this week was make one pair of bead earrings, and they're bloody beautiful,
mm-hmm.
it's a win. Yeah. Or if all I did this week was take one walk around the lake at the Arboretum, that's a win. Having to absolutely rewrite my sense of what an achievement is, of rewriting my expectations, absolutely altered me. I got involved volunteering with a couple of local groups. So suddenly it was less about changing the world and just going, I just need to leave the house today. If I could have a shower and clean my teeth, that would be a win. And then if I've helped somebody fill a form in when I've got to where I'm volunteering, fantastic. So I think it was just reframing what Suki's idea of success even looked like.
Yeah.
And I think it, in a way, it just meant a lot more, because it, instead of it being very externally driven, it became far kinder and far more internally driven.
Yeah, it almost sounds like hitting a reset button.
Yeah.
Because up to then, so often your reaction to things was to speed up. And so with this, you were forced to slow right down, and it kind of reset what you see as an achievement, because you're going from a completely different place. So any improvement on that is an improvement.
Yeah. And then a couple of years in, so I'm still living in Warsaw, I'm earning less than minimum wage, because at this point I'm now, you know, making jewellery and selling it. And one of my old friends gets back in touch, and she's now working at the Tutu Foundation, which is Desmond Tutu's foundation, to say, would I be involved in getting a community project off the ground, which is called Conversations for Change.
Mm-hmm.
And Conversations for Change is built upon the African philosophy of Ubuntu, which in its purest distilled form is that I'm only okay if you're all okay, that I can't be okay by myself. And it was used during the peace and reconciliation process in South Africa. You've got to rebuild a country. I've done you wrong, you've done me wrong, we've both done Danny wrong, but at some point we need to reopen this school, we need to reopen the government, we need to make sure that that road is tarmacked. And so within the peace and reconciliation process, we have to acknowledge the wrongs we've done each other, but we also need to rebuild an existence.
Mm-hmm.
And we rebuild that existence upon the principles that we have far more in common than what separates us.
Right.
The fundamental things in life, such as the health and happiness of our friends and family, or the fact that we want a clean environment, or the fact that we have the same fears, we have far more in common than separates us. And so I was very, very lucky to be part of a group of facilitators who literally were given the remit of, we need to make this into a program. And we went off, worked collaboratively for like an intensive long weekend, and created the Conversations for Change program. So using the principles of Ubuntu and then delivering it across the UK to what would be disadvantaged communities. So we're talking about geographical areas that hit the indices of deprivation. So we're talking about communities where there'd been gun violence, or there was intergenerational conflict, or there was religious conflict. And we had to be invited in. We didn't helicopter ourselves in. It would have to be a local community group that would invite us in. And we would help facilitate the process of creating conversations. So we would be there for I think a couple of weekends and create spaces for people to talk about their fears, talk about their experiences, to talk about how they would want their community to look. And I think that not only was it some of the most powerful work I've done, it was a sort of work that I couldn't have done before my breakdown, because I would have done that work before my breakdown with a focus on metrics. What are we going to achieve? What are we going to deliver? How many communities are we going to deliver in? How many people? It would have just come from the wrong heart space to actually be in communities and to be raw myself, because I felt like a newborn baby back out in the world. Like, oh my God, they've asked me to do this piece of work. I've been in my pyjamas for the last 6 months. I had to bring a different part of myself to that work, and I think I was just so much richer for it.
Right. It sounds like you'd had a fundamental shift, that prior to the breakdown there was almost, I'm visualizing like puppetry going on, that you're so busy keeping up this facade and this kind of perfect, strong, productive person that's constantly reaching new heights, keeping all that going almost from behind the scenes. You're not even hardly inside your own body, to then go through this and be forced to check in with yourself. And now you're in a project where you're far more on the ground than ever before.
And far more on the ground with myself, Bobby. And yeah, that, I think, is the fundamental truth. That bit of, even when we'd created the programme, so there was, you know, there's a number of us facilitators working on creating that programme, and to actually think, well, I'm actually a guinea pig in this programme, because I'm as much a facilitator and a creator and as much a recipient of it, because I certainly can't hold the space for authentic conversations if I'm not being authentic myself. If I am literally coming into this space going, well, how many of which community did we have? And that's my idea of a metric, as opposed to, I got 3 hugs as people left and they said, thank you for coming. Well, I think I would sooner measure any metric by a hug than, you know, can you please fill in our feedback form? And and I think that was the point at which I knew I'd turned a corner and I wasn't who I'd pretended to be up till that point.
Right, and there's so much power in that ability to be vulnerable and to really sit in uncomfortable spaces and be yourself. And often it does take learning that. We're taught that it's all about the job, it's all about the salary and the car and who you've married and how rich your family is. And actually, all of that can melt away so quickly, whether you're at the top of your game or not. All it can take, with the subject of burnout, for example, is just overworking yourself, and it can all come crashing down. But actually, there's so much greater power in being yourself and embracing that individuality. So many people see that with me having this podcast, just being so open about mental health and my personal ups and downs. People find that intimidating more often than they find that weak. And that's something that I kind of understood in theory, but sometimes you have to go through the process to really be forced to internalise it.
Oh, absolutely. And that's your superpower. Because I always say that my superpower is holding the space. That is literally what I do. My job on the planet is to be a facilitator.
Right.
I hold the space for other people. And if part of that space is ending stigma, whether it's about mental health issues or about forced marriage or anything else, that's what I was put on the planet to do, to just hold the space for other people. And I think that's immensely powerful.
Absolutely. And within a mental health context, so much of counselling is based off that, about creating safe spaces for people to explore the parts of themselves that they don't understand yet. That there's no right or wrong. Sometimes we just need a safe space to be open and to challenge ourselves. And I have so much admiration for anyone that has the ability to create that.
We're all part of that tribe. And to me, having that confidence that the tribe is growing gives me a lot of reassurance, it gives me hope, it gives me optimism, because none of us can do it by ourselves.
Right. For me as well, a lot of this creating deep and meaningful conversations, whatever the context of them, I don't think we are hateful by default. I don't think anyone's born bad, but somewhere along the line, we've either learned an incorrect thing or we've gone down a difficult path, and it's led us to a place where we've learned to hate, or we've learned to purposely stay ignorant to something. And that's where so much of stigma is, that people are like, oh, I'm not going to go too much near the crazies because I might catch something. And I really wonder where that comes from at times, but I think a lot of the time it's in the air, and unless we can break that down, we're always going to have problems of discrimination, whether they're to do with mental health, whether they're to do with how somebody is or isn't coping in the workplace, whatever it is. So it's so wonderful to hear that you've found that skill, you've found it, really sounds like your calling.
I feel really honoured that it found me. And I think it took the conversations for change work for me to really realise it's what I do in the spaces. So, yes, I can do what are phenomenal projects, but it is holding that space. And in this last, you know, few years, I find myself in the private sector, in the corporate world, and especially doing a lot of my wellbeing work. And that, to me, that I can be this unashamed ambassador or champion for holding the space, for having these conversations. I can stand up in front of a room and talk candidly about my breakdown or about menopause, and it will create other conversations. That sometimes you just need to get the ball rolling. And I think that something is shifting in the air, especially around mental health or mentally confident conversations. That is shifting, but we still have a long way to go.
Right, absolutely. And it sounds like you're very much at the forefront of that, because I'm sure you find, like I do, that people are crying out for that, that you don't realise anybody wants to talk about it at times until you start, and then everyone has an anecdote they're desperate to share. And so could you talk us through, just to finish up then, where you're at with your current work, what it is you do?
Yeah, so I run an employee wellbeing business called Happy Maven, which I actually launched only 18 months ago after I realised that the whole issues, not just around anxiety or stress management, but about unaddressed burnout, were not just personal to me. Who knew? Who knew that if you scratch the surface, there are many people struggling with similar issues? And the reason that I didn't want to take a role within HR or, you know, sort of a well-being officer was because I don't want to be constrained by the discussions that I need to have. I want to sit across from a CEO or from a board chair and tell him or her exactly how it is, what it's costing them in human terms, what it's costing their bottom line, and to actually make real and powerful changes within workplaces. And I hope that's a little bit of what I do.
Yeah, that's so wonderful. What a lovely, succinct way to finish. One more thing I'll mention is that you said off air that David Beeney, a previous guest of ours, was a big help in setting up your current business. So if anyone wants to explore the topic of mental health in the workplace further, we've got a mini series of that, and David Beeney was one of the guests. So that is, if you scroll back a few episodes, you'll be able to find our mental health in the workplace mini series. And so we'll finish up there then. Thank you so much for being on the podcast
today.
Thank
you for having me. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.